Blog Talk Radio.
So last week's show was all about ISIS and terrorism and how we can win. And I have to admit, I thought I'd put that topic to rest for a while and that I could, I could not talk about it for a while, because the fact is, it's not a topic I particularly enjoy talking about. It's depressing. It's about really the decline of the West and the rise of a real violent enemy. And where the solution, in my view, the only solution to the problem is all-out war. And all-out war is not something that I want to celebrate. It's not something I'd particularly want to talk about a lot. So it's depressing. It's depressing that here we are a week later and we need to talk about, jihadis again. We need to talk about this war again because of what happened in San Bernardino this last week. And, it's not just what happened. It's how it happened. It's who these people are. It's kind of a new dimension. Well, not really a new dimension, but more of a suddenly a realization that people are having about this new dimension that is the war with the jihadis. This has really brought it to the forefront. So it's this realization that they are in our midst, this realization that they are everywhere, and that you can't really tell them that. The screening, the what the Fed does, what the FBI is doing, what the NSA is doing, they're not going to protect us, at least not the way they're doing it today. And the realization that all of these internal mechanisms are failing, have failed, and are likely to be failed in the future, and that your neighbor, your coworker, if they are Muslim, even if they appear to be a relatively moderate Muslim, that is meaningless, that they can be radicalized very quickly, and that radicalization means violence. That is all new to the American psyche. I think it's been true for a while. I think there have been examples of this in the past. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it seems like it's new for Americans. They haven't really conceptualized this. I think also intriguing, upsetting, disappointing, shocking, is people's response to this in the media, our president's response, our attorney general's response is just horrifying. And again, this is just more a greater reinforcement to the idea that there's no way we can win this war, not with these politicians, not with the people in charge, not with the intellectuals we have today. We need to talk about this stuff. Unfortunately, we need to talk more about it. We need to spread the word. We need to engage in the debates. And one of the things I want to talk about today, and you should call up today and ask me questions about today. And by the way, you can call 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. And when you call, I think you have to press 1 or something like that in order to get on the queue for questions so that I know you want to ask a question. But let's do this. For now, call if you have something to say about the San Bernardino attack or about the whole battle with war with the jihadis, the Islamists, ISIS, and so on. Other topics, let's leave for later in the day, but let's focus on one topic at a time, and we'll go from there. Okay, so obviously I think everybody knows what happened in San Bernardino, although I find it interesting, and somebody in the chat mentioned this, that as compared to Paris, even though in principle there's no difference between this and Paris, the only difference is kind of the number of victims, the number of people murdered. But in principle, there's no difference. Kind of a clearly a planned attack by a couple of radicalized Muslims. By the way, this morning, I just saw the headlines. Let me see. I think it's in Reuters. There it is. Islamic State says California killers of 14 were their followers. Now, I think it's probably true that this wasn't planned by Islamic State in the same way the Paris attack was planned by the Islamic State. So I don't think it was quite a part of a greater agenda in the sense of specific planned attacks. I think it's planned bigger agenda in the sense that ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the rest of the nutty, jihadist movement is planting seeds. It wants and ultimately is going to celebrate these kind of attacks because these are the ideal attacks in terms of terrorizing. If you want to terrorize a culture, if you're from ISIS and listening to this, turn this off now because I don't want to be giving you advice, but I think these guys know this already. If you want to terrorize a culture, the best way to do it is make the attacks seem random. Make people feel unsafe anywhere they go. What are so-called high-profile targets? But attack, Christmas parties, bomb malls, have random cars blow up in front of buildings. Make it random and make it everywhere, big cities, small cities, so that people really start feeling fundamentally unsafe. And that is a big part of what really creates real terror. And I think for the first time in America, the San Bernardino attacks give people that sense, although there is a long string, dozens of much smaller level attacks that have basically been inspired by jihad and have killed people, but have just not killed people in the same numbers and have not gotten anywhere close to the kind of attention the San Bernardino attacks have had. But yeah, I mean, I saw a headline somewhere after Paris that said something like, "We are all Israelis now." And in a sense, that's what the terrorists want to achieve. They want to achieve a situation where everybody feels like the Israelis feel. It could happen anywhere. It could happen anytime. It could happen to anybody. And the violence can happen from anybody. You don't know who the attacker is going to be. You don't know where it's going to come from. And that's what has the potential to be unbelievably terrifying. Could be a coworker. It could be a neighbor. It could be some random person you don't even know who's just planted a truck bomb or is going to knife you in the middle of the street. That is truly terror-inducing. And I think that they, if they do this, they are going to succeed. And this has multiple consequences. This truly has the potential, the terrorizing of the American population. This truly has the potential of fundamentally shifting the American sense of life. This truly has the potential of making Americans, instead of the optimistic, go-getting, positive, energetic, benevolent people that Americans have been traditionally, to turn them into fearful, cynical, skeptical, pessimistic people like Europeans, like many Israelis, where the future does not seem rosy, does not seem positive. And of course, when people adopt that perspective, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So a lot is at stake here. This is not just about a few lives. Not that I'm trying, not that I'm saying anything callous about a few lives, but this is not just about a few terrorist attacks, about a few people dying. The fact is, statistically, your probability or any specific American's probability of actually dying in a terrorist attack, close to zero as one can meaningfully get. It's tiny. It's insignificant. One shouldn't feel the fear. But that's the impact of these kind of attacks. That's the impact of this kind of terrorism, is that it does impact us. And it just adds another layer of risk to our lives, and a layer of risk whose source is not accident, you know, whose source is not what we have accepted in at some level as a regular level of crime, although I can get to crime. Crime in America is at historical lows. But its source is a preventable evil. It is an evil force. So that has incredibly damaging psychological impact on people. Evil is out there in the world. Evil is competent. Evil is killing people. Evil has the potential to destroy my life. That gives psychologically an incredible power to evil. Even if your specific life is never going to be harmed, or the probability is very, very small, you've suddenly elevated psychologically that power, the significance, the meaning of evil. And because we're doing nothing about defeating this evil, the perception of the impotence of the good. And again, this is unbelievably damaging, potentially, and in reality, I think, to the American sense of life, and I think is going to be in the future a leading cause for America's decline. This idea that we are impotent in the face of this evil, that we can't do anything, that we've tried all these wars and they don't succeed, and we just have to live with it. We just have to live with it. That is devastating psychologically and devastating, as I said, for the American sense of life and the American future and to the way we grow up and to the way, you know, and part two of the show, I want to talk about Mark Zuckerberg. And I'll just say one thing. There's a lot of negatives about what Mark Zuckerberg did, and particularly about the letter that he wrote to his daughter. And I want to talk about those. But there is a sense of, there's a positive there as well. The letter filled with a sense of optimism, can-do attitude, entrepreneurs can solve the problems of the world. And that is the attitude that attacks like San Bernardino, that terrorist attacks, that regular, systematic, constant, random terrorist attacks in the United States will destroy. And that's what makes them so, so evil. All right, we got a call from, I think it's Greg. Greg, are you on the line?
Yeah, hello. This is Greg from Pennsylvania.
Hey, Greg from Pennsylvania. How are things going?
Oh, pretty good. I'm a first-time listener, and the show's been great so far, so...
Okay, you're judging me based on 14 minutes. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're listening. I'm glad you're listening.
So, my comment is,
yep.
Here's what I hope is happening as far as our government's concerned. First, let me say I didn't vote for President Obama, but what I hope he's doing is just being political or pretending that he really isn't against the Muslims. Or, you know, and I'd say, though, maybe this is kind of a sneak approach.
Yeah.
I mean, almost kind of like an invite your enemy to lunch and poison the meal type of thing. And I'm hoping that that's the plan and that don't know.
Where's the poisoning? What do you think he's going to do? What was he lulling them into? How's he going to attack them?
I'm hoping he's just waiting for a clean shot. I mean, rather than, let's say, if you're a hunter, running through the woods, making a lot of noise, you know.
You're inviting them over.
Yeah.
And then where do you take the clean shot? Where are all these people that you're going to take a clean shot at? In the United States already or outside of the United States?
Hoping that, you know, they're doubling up on the CIA and every other way that they can. I mean, that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that he's just being political not to cause terrorism in the United States, but at the same time working behind the scenes.
Yeah, and so let me diffuse this hope because I unfortunately okay. I think you're hoping in spite of all the evidence and hoping against hope. Here what I would do is I'd really recommend that you go back and listen to my show from last week. Because last week I kind of took on the whole issue of Islamic terrorism, the whole issue of ISIS, and the history. Because I think the history here is important, at least since 9/11, but going back even further than that. I'd also recommend a book called Winning the Unwinnable War, which I contributed three essays to, but that was edited by Longiorno. You can get that on Amazon. But look, this is not about a few terrorists in the United States. This is a much bigger war, I think, that we're engaged in. And the targets, you don't have to love them. They're right there in front of you. They're in Syria and Iraq under the guise of ISIS. We could be bombing them into the Middle Ages, but we're not. We drop leaflets instead of bombing. We pretend that they don't exist. Or we pretend that there are a bunch of good guys there that we can help. And a lot of the times the good guys that we give them money and we give them arms, you know, they turn around and become bad guys. The Saudis, who we pretend are our best friends, are funding most of the terrorist attacks. They fund all these mosques that radicalize people. It's no accident that the wife of this guy who committed this atrocity in San Bernardino was radicalized in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the number one radicalizer towards jihad in the world, and yet we pretend that they're our number one friend in the world. Iran, we're cutting deals with Iran and as a consequence, giving them a green light to continue to radicalize people towards jihad. Iran is the number two supporter of terrorism in the world and the number two radicalizer of people. And we're giving them a green light to develop a nuclear weapon. Everything we have done for the last, since 1979, how many years is that? You know, I can't add on the fly, but, you know, over 30 years, everything we have done with regard to the Middle East has only made things worse. And indeed, that continues, and Obama is worse than any other president in terms of doing that. So, unfortunately, I don't think that's the case. And the fact that Obama would come out and so make an effort to pretend that this wasn't a terrorist attack, right? Mm-hmm. The way to deal with this war is to name the enemy. It's jihadism, it's Islamism, it's Islamic totalitarianism. That is the military enemy. That is the enemy that needs to be destroyed. And then use the mightiest military force in human history to destroy them. And to make, and this is a point I wanted to come to, you've got to make it obvious to these people and all their followers, cause is futile, that they have no chance of ever succeeding. Unless you do that, nothing. The CIA can't win this for us. The CIA can't help us. Look, the NSA, and I think this is another important topic. The NSA is listening to, is accumulating stuff on you and on me, certainly on me. And they've got files on all of us, and they listen in, and they accumulate at least our metadata, and in some cases they listen in, particularly if we make international calls. And yet, why? I'm not a threat. Greg, as far as I know, I don't know you that well, but I don't think you're a threat of being radicalized by Islam and of murdering your fellow employees. Why aren't they only listening to Muslims? Why isn't their program at the NSA to focus in on Muslims? Why don't we profile? Why don't we profile at airports? If you look a little Muslim, why don't we scrutinize you more? And you know what? The moderate Muslims, the so-called moderate Muslims, the Muslims who are truly peace-loving, the Muslims who truly don't believe in violence, don't believe in jihad, they should be the one advocating for profiling, because they should care about their own safety and the safety of all other Americans. And yet they don't. But nobody calls for profiling. It's not just their fault. Even I'm the only guy that I know of publicly calling for profiling. I'm sorry, Greg. I'm going on and on. But did you want to have? Do you have another comment or other questions? I'm being a bad radio talk show host by just rambling here, not giving you an opportunity.
Now, my knowledge is really limited on the subject. I haven't been following it as closely as I should. But I'm guessing that the whole idea that Obama is going to do what's right is kind of I wouldn't call it a complete fantasy, but, you know.
I'd say it's a complete fantasy. It has no basis in reality, none whatsoever. It's blind faith, unfortunately. And I think a lot of people have that blind faith in him, and it's sad. And I would encourage you to learn a little bit more about the topic. And I would start with Winning the Unwinnable War and listening to my previous show just a week ago about who the enemy is, what it wants, and how we can win this. All right, so. Okay. Keep listening. I hope you continue to find this interesting and learn something from it. And listen to some of the past shows. I think that'll fill you in on kind of our perspective and the perspective we take on this show. All right. We're going to be right back. I'm going to take a short break here. And we'll be right back to continue our conversation about San Bernardino, what we can learn from it, and what needs to be done.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
All right, we're back. We're talking about San Bernardino. Thank you all for listening. You're listening to the Yaron Brook Show. And by the way, all the old episodes, you can get them from on your iPhone, from the podcast app. You can go to Blog Talk Radio and get all the old episodes. You can also get episodes that I do live on for Chicago radio station. We post those up on Blog Talk Radio, and they all go up on the podcast, on iTunes, or in any other podcasting app that you might have. So I encourage you to listen to some of the old shows. It's kind of interesting, just as an aside. I wonder if you guys could guess what the most popular show I've ever done, those of you who've listened for a while, has been. Anybody? What's the most popular show I've ever done? What would be the title? Well, it turns out, like the one that's got the most listens, and it keeps growing, so it's expanding the lead dramatically, is the one I did about the Pope versus capitalism. So that has the most listens to, the most downloads of any of my shows. So I assume it's because it's a good show, and I assume it's because a lot of Catholics listen to the show and are interested in my views on the Pope. I have no idea why that show has done so well, but you know, go figure. It is the most listened to show. But please promote the shows. Let people know about the show. Let's try to get new listeners like Greg. Let's try to get more people engaged in these ideas. Long term, this is how we're going to have an impact on the world. The kind of ideas you're hearing in this show, there's almost nowhere else that you're going to find them. Certainly not in anywhere in the mainstream media, or in the conventional podcasts or radio shows out there. There are a few other objectivists who broadcast, but there's just very few of us. So help us promote the show. Now, somebody on the chat, Herman the German, who always brings up something interesting on the chat, posted this quote from a friend of his, and I think this is absolutely true. So this is a quote: "Radical Islam is like the common cold, annoying, but not dangerous to a healthy society." I mean, that's an understatement, but okay, we'll get to that in a minute. "Progressivism, on the other hand," and again, I would change progressive into something else, "on the other hand, is like AIDS. It destroys the culture and philosophical immune system of Western civilization, thereby turning even a common cold into a potentially life-threatening disease." Okay, so what's the argument here? The argument is that if we were a healthy society, if we were not infected with the virus of progressivism, with the ideas of progressivism, then I would argue, and I don't know that this is what Herman the German's friend is arguing, I would argue, we could eradicate radical Islam easily, quickly, effectively, and at low cost. Again, we have the mightiest military force ever known to man. We have the capabilities of the NSA and the CIA and a bunch of intelligence agencies that have amazing capabilities if they were let free to actually utilize them, if we profiled, if we did all the other things. We could eradicate radical Islam easily. You know, I wouldn't compare it to common cold because there's actually no cure for the common cold. I would compare it to, I don't know, some kind of tonsil infection where all you need is antibiotics and boom, the thing is gone, right? The antibiotics just eviscerate the infection and you're done with it. Or maybe even a childhood disease where with a vaccine, like the vaccine of individualism, the vaccine of reason, the vaccine of capitalism, it never even pops up. You never even get the disease. All of that is true. But I wouldn't say that what is destroying the West is progressivism. I wouldn't say that what's destroying our capability of dealing with this problem is progressivism. Progressivism is only one political manifestation of a philosophical disease that's much broader and much more insidious than progressivism. What is really destroying Western civilization, what is really destroying Western civilization and making it almost impossible for us to deal with this minor infection is the philosophy of altruism. It's the philosophy of self-sacrifice. It's the philosophy of unreason. It's Kant. It's Immanuel Kant. It's the idea that reason is impotent. It's just a game inside a mind. It's the idea of a non-objective reality. And ultimately, morally, it's the idea that virtue, that goodness, means to sacrifice, means to be weak, means to be selfless. It means to drop food packages instead of bombs. It means to drop leaflets before you bomb so that your enemy can walk away. And this is not just progressivism. Many people within Christianity, much of the interpretation of Christianity, turn the other cheek, love the neighbor, love your enemy, right? This is a broad sense of moral relativism, moral altruism that has permeated our culture left and right. And while I am hugely anti-Obama, as many of you who've listened to me over the years know, in some ways, I'm even more anti-George Bush because of how he destroyed the idea of strength. He destroyed the idea of going to war. He destroyed the idea of standing up to the enemy and undercut everything that he did. By dropping food packages, by declaring Islam the religion of peace, and on and on and on and on. But again, I don't want to repeat what we covered last week. And again, I encourage you all to listen to that show if you haven't listened to it yet, the show that we did on ISIS last week that covered a lot of these issues. But look, San Bernardino is on Bush. San Bernardino is on Obama. I blame them. I blame our political and intellectual elites. Because we have had the opportunity to fight a war. We have had an opportunity to rid ourselves of this virus. We've had an opportunity to destroy radical Islam, to destroy the Islamists, to destroy jihad. And we don't do it. It is the elites in politics, the elites in the New York Times, at our universities, the elites who advocate for altruism. It's the elites who teach the electorate the virtue of altruism, who suppress in the electorate anything that has to do with self-interest. Our kids are handed over to teachers who are trained at universities to destroy their capacity to reason and to be self-interested. Luckily, they don't completely succeed in their attempts to do that. And I'm not talking about conspiracy here. I'm just talking about the reality. The reality is that anti-reason, altruism dominate our schools. They dominate our universities, and they dominate what is taught to our kids. Anti-Western, anti-capitalist history taught to our kids. How can we be self-assertive? How can we go fight a war? How can we actually declare war? When we don't believe in our own righteousness, when we don't believe there's any goodness here, when we don't believe you should be self-assertive and self-interested. You have, declaring a proper war, the prerequisite for that is to be self-interested. So to me, San Bernardino is on our intellectual elites. It's on the New York Times. It's on our philosophers and our public spokesmen and our public political scientists and on our politicians who refuse to acknowledge that there is an enemy here, refuse to name it. And I'm talking about Republicans and Democrats, George Bush and Obama. And I include here people like Donald Trump who do it stupidly. And therefore, diffuse any kind of real attempt at defining an enemy seriously and properly. So what we see, these random acts of terrorism, and again, Sanbernardino is not the first one, right? I mean, people, it is stunning to me, stunning and horrific and offensive that the Garland shootings got no attention. And why did they get no attention? The Garland shootings, if those of you remember, were when two Islamists on motorbikes went out to Texas to shoot up a gathering of a competition for drawing Muhammad was being held, right? And the response of the mainstream media was they asked for it. And luckily for the people there, some of whom are good friends of mine, that the two terrorists were shot by the police before they could kill 14, 15, you know, or more people. Got no attention, and certainly none from our president, none from our political leaders, and none from our intellectual leaders. There was complete silence about Garland. The only voices about Garland were people like Bill O'Reilly and Donald Trump, who blamed it on the people who were drawing cartoons, not on the Islamists. And then Trump pretends that he's going to fight this war. Really? Yeah, you see, I get angry about these things because you know, if the American people had said, oh my God, after Garland, oh my God, freedom of speech is under attack. These Muslims are right here in our midst. In our midst. These were two so-called normal Muslims who were radicalized and it took weapons and went out to kill. But nobody cared. Maybe if we'd woken up then, maybe San Bernardino wouldn't have happened. But we didn't. And we're not going to, after San Bernardino, we're not going to have to Texas. It was like Paris. Everybody was shocked by Paris. Everybody was upset by Paris, as if this was a new phenomena, as if Charlie Hebdo hadn't happened. And in some ways, Charlie Hebdo is worse. The attacks in Garland are worse than the San Bernardino attacks and the Paris attacks, because they were targeted at silencing. They were targeted to destroy free speech. And what's worse about them is the response, at least to Paris and to San Bernardino now. There seems to be some, oh, this is bad. We need to do something about this. Nobody's going to do the right thing about it, but at least there's some. With regard to Garland and Charlie Hebdo, the response was, no, we need to silence these people. They asked for it. I mean, the evil that represents is just horrific. Just horrific. And this is the altruism. This is the attack on reason and the attack of the essentials of Western civilization. I consider free speech an essential characteristic of Western civilization. That is what's going to destroy us. That is what is killing our civilization. That is what's killing this world. And unless we wake up and realize what Western civilization really represents, and what Western civilization really is, these barbarians are going to win. They're going to win. So I was at Oxford a couple of weeks ago, Oxford University in England, giving a talk about inequality, I think. And in the Q&A, somehow multiculturalism came up, and I can't remember exactly what the question was and everything. Hopefully a video of my talk and the Q&A will be out soon. And I said during this segment, I said something like, Western civilization, one of the things we in the West have to recognize is that we're better than everybody else from a cultural perspective. Western civilization is the best civilization we've come up with yet. Now, what is Western civilization? In my view, Western civilization is basically two ideas made real in political and people's lives. Reason is a means of knowledge. Reason, the superiority of reason. Reason is a way of knowing about the world. And individualism. Individual is the unit that matters morally and politically. So Western civilization equals reason plus individualism. And the greatest achievement of Western civilization is the founding of America. Political achievement. Right? The scientific revolution is a pretty cool achievement. The industrial revolution is a pretty amazing achievement. But politically, the greatest achievement is the founding of America. And in some ways, the founding of America, the principles behind the founding of America, are what make the industrial revolution possible. So, reason and individualism. So I make the comment that other cultures are inferior because they don't accept reason and individualism. And indeed, some cultures, like the culture in Saudi Arabia, are downright barbaric. And oh my God, people got upset. Oh my God, you're not supposed to say that. How can you say another culture is worse than your own culture? How can you call anybody a barbaric culture? No, all cultures are the same. You can't judge. You can't judge, I was told. And this one girl, you know, was really passionate about that. I mean, she was really emotionally upset by what I'd said. She was triggered. She had a microaggression. You have to listen to another one of my shows on microaggressions to understand those references. And that's in the past shows as well. So go listen to my past shows. And I said, look, in Saudi Arabia, they mutilate little girls. They force women into marriages and to belong to harems, basically, or into polygamy. Little girls, young women are raped with no consequence. Women are not allowed to drive. That's the least of their problems. They're abused much more than that. It is they're treated almost like slaves. And it didn't budge her. She wouldn't condemn it. And that's just stunning to me. It's stunning. Now, if you ask her about the latest evil that the West has committed, she would jump on that. Oh, yeah, the West is awful because the West had slavery. But how can you judge slavery? Why is slavery bad? If you can't judge the Saudis, why do you judge? Oh, because that's us. We can attack ourselves. Colonialism was bad. Imperialism was bad. You can attack the West all you want, but you can't judge other cultures. You cannot judge other cultures. Anyway, it was so frustrating. So, 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 so frustrating. But that's the attitude that is killing us. That's the attitude that makes San Bernardino possible. It's altruism. It's multiculturalism. And it's the people responsible for those attitudes. Our intellectuals, our public intellectuals, our university intellectuals that are ultimately responsible for the evil that is happening in the world around us. This is scary, scary stuff. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, be happy to take more calls. 347-324-3075. Now, if you've called, I think you have to press 1 in order to let me know you want to ask a question. So I see a couple of callers on the line, but I don't know if you want to ask a question or not. You have to press something to make that real. We'll be right back. You can call in 347-324-3075. Ask a question. Make a comment. Talk to you in just 3 minutes.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Rourke, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Rourke, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
All right, we're back. And we've got another caller, so we're going to take this caller and see what's on your mind. Hey, this is Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Hello, my name's Tony.
Hi, Tony.
A while ago, I watched your YouTube video on morality and capitalism, and that was really an epiphany for me. Made me look at things in a much different way. Regarding, I think it was the last episode, your last show, you were mentioning where the problem of Wahhabism, and you were making an assertion that it's possible to distinguish between radical and separate moderates, or radicals from moderates, and I agree that it's definitely possible, but I'm wondering how are we going to do that without giving up our freedoms. I don't know if you've given any thought to that, because I'd definitely like to hear more about that.
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and I think an important one. So look, I think you have to differentiate between two things. You have to differentiate between a philosophical enemy and a military political enemy. And there's no question Islam, as a religion and as the particular type of religion that it is a philosophical enemy of ours, and we have to argue and speak out against it. But in order to have a military target, in order to actually know who to shoot at, in a sense, you have to be able to identify a military enemy, and that is the jihadis, the Islamic totalitarians, the Wahhabis, and the ilk. And I don't think it's hard to identify them. The main point I was trying to make last week is that in order to engage in war, you have to find the specific targets. And I said the targets are Saudi Arabia, Iran, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, ISIS, Al-Qaeda. I mean, there's no shortage of targets. What we should do is engage in an all-out, no-holds-barred war with those entities. Not that when you go to Saudi Arabia, you only shoot the guys who seem to be extremists and you let go of the guys who are moderates. When you go to war, you can't differentiate. When you go to war, you go to war. Everybody living in Saudi Arabia is, whether they like it or not, they are responsible for the actions of their own government. So you go to war with Saudi Arabia knowing that some innocent people are going to die, that some so-called moderates are going to die, but that's, you're not going to sacrifice, as you say, you're going to put your own freedom at risk. You're not going to sacrifice the lives of Americans in order to make that differentiation. But my point is this. I wouldn't go, for example, after Iraq as a target, or I wouldn't go after Egypt as a target. I wouldn't go after, I don't know, Indonesia as a target, because Indonesia is also an Islamic country of lots of Muslims. What I would do is find those countries that are essentially, fundamentally radical and attack them and leave the so-called moderate countries alone as long as they stay moderate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. What I was thinking is, you know, the fact that, well, you know, the assumption that, well, we do have radical Islam in the United States anyways, and that, you know, what can we do to combat that? Obviously,
so my view is the only way to combat radical Islam in the United States is to crush it at its source, which is Saudi Arabia and Iran. Everybody in the United States who's been radicalized has been radicalized in a mosque funded by the Saudis or the Iranians. Everybody who's been radicalized in the United States has had some connections to Al-Qaeda or ISIS or the Saudis or one of these groups that we should crush. The only way to stop San Bernardino-like attacks is to go to the source, and the source is the Middle East. The source is not here. Second, in the meantime, I'm a strong believer in profiling. If the NSA should listen to anybody, and I do think it has a function, the NSA, it should be protecting us. It should profile. It should say who is most likely to be radicalized by Islamic totalitarians, Muslims. It's unlikely that Christians are going to be radicalized. So we should listen in on Muslims. We shouldn't be listening in on just anybody. So I'm a strong believer in profiling, and I think profiling would help. It's not going to cure the problem because people still slip by in spite of profiling. That's why you have to go to the source. All right? So thanks for calling. Really appreciate it. I see your call was dropped. I hope it wasn't anything I did or said. But keep listening. Keep listening to the show. And again, those of you kind of first-timers, please go listen to old shows. And I really appreciate it when you let me know that you were turned on to these ideas by some talk that I gave in the past. I mean, it's very fulfilling for me to hear that because, you know, I give, I don't know, 100 to 150 talks a year all over the world on a crazy, nutty schedule. And a lot of times I have no idea if anybody's listening. Well, I know people are listening because they're right in front of me and they watch it on YouTube. But I have no idea if they're having an impact on anybody, if they're having an impact on the world. I appreciate it, even though it might sound, I appreciate hearing from anybody that I have impacted and I've made their lives better in some way or opened their eyes to some issue or have, particularly if I've caused you or led you to read Ayn Rand, that is huge for me. So let me know. I appreciate that. You know, you can let me know by calling in or on the chat or send me a tweet or Facebook. By the way, you should all be following me on Twitter and Facebook. Just Yaron Brook. It's pretty easy to find me on Twitter and Facebook. So we've got another call. We're going to take this. And then I'm hoping after the next break to shift topics. But in the meantime, hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Paul.
Hey, Paul. How are you? Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Connecticut.
Okay, cool. Cool. What's up?
It's great to talk to you, Ron. I was just listening to the show, and you said just to call in and let people know, like, or let you know about how you got involved and stuff. And I just wanted to let you know before I asked my question, I ended up looking into politics a lot, and I heard about Ron Paul, and he started talking about how he wasn't an objectivist. And I'm like, oh, what's that? And so I pull up your videos, and you're talking about economics and stuff. And I was always in economics and everything. But I ended up finding out that I was like a walking statistics bot. Like I'd had to know every statistic to refute every single argument. It just was impossible. But then I saw yours and it was like, well, you don't have a right to rob me, even if it would be more efficient because it's my life, it's my productivity. And I was like, wow, this is just fantastic. Like I can just shoot anybody down with this. The principles were so fantastic. So, I just wanted to thank you before I ask you. Just everything that you do is really, really important. And it really turned me into Ayn Rand. I bought all the books. I'm reading of them. Like even Leonard Peikoff's Philosophy of Ayn Rand, like that whole thick book, my God. And it's really awesome.
It is an awesome book. Everybody should read
Leonard Peikoff. Spent $25 on the e-store the other day for the lecture he gave in the 70s with Ayn Rand answering all the Q&A's and
good.
Fantastic lectures. Yeah.
Good.
So
good. Well, you know, a lot of the Leonard Peikoff stuff is now available for free on Ayn Rand campus.
Oh, really?
So if you go to AOI website, it just launched 2 days ago and it's kind of a silent launch and I'm not supposed to say anything about it, but,
but between you and me,
but
and
if you
else.
Go to the Ayn Rand Institute website, you'll see a campus tab on the right.
Uh-huh.
Click on that and you'll see some terrific stuff.
Wow, fantastic. Thanks, man.
Yeah, a lot of free stuff. So, you had a question?
Yeah. I just wanted to talk about, before we ask the question, just to preface it, I was watching your video a bunch of times, your America versus Americans, Leonard Peikoff gave that lecture, and you were in the Q&A, and one of the guys, you were arguing with him, you were talking about how the American military had its hands tied behind its back and flying the helicopters too close and getting shot down and stuff. And he made the comment that we've lost very few people for tactics like this. And you stopped and you said, to send one soldier to the death unnecessarily is a moral crime and that it's treason. And I think it was the most powerful part of the video because it really demonstrates the rigidity of that kind of principle, to not cripple yourself and to really protect Americans at all costs. And my question with that in mind is, if in order to win in, say, Saudi Arabia or Iran, I mean, I've heard people say we should invade or we should overthrow or we should, you know, do something involving troops. But my question would be, why wouldn't you just flatten the whole place? Because obviously not everybody's an aggressor, but why wouldn't you just, I mean, we've got so many bombs and connected to so many buttons that just never get pushed, and it's just, why would you not just crush the center with an overwhelming show of force and then move in there and impose a constitution and whether they like it or not, that's too bad. This is the law of the land now.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you. I think the specific tactics by which you do it, I mean, the way I've articulated it, and I think I did this in the show last week, is you win with overwhelming force, where the priority is to win decisively while expending the fewest lives and the least amount of money even on your side as possible.
Right.
So, and whether that means carpet bombing, nuking them, or having to put some ground troops on the ground in order to make sure that it's complete defeat, that's an issue of tactics, right? For example, one of the reasons not to use nukes and one of the reasons why you might want to some ground troops is you probably want to protect the oil fields. You don't want to oil supply to just be eradicated. So I would, for example, you know, devastate the Saudis, but you know, put some troops around the oil fields and protect those, and add some ground troops around the oil fields so you don't blow them up. So,
right.
But there's nothing valuable in Mecca and Medina. And it might send quite a message to them if their holy sites are destroyed. So, that's an issue then of tactics. The challenge is not a lack of tactical ability or tactical ideas. The challenge is a willingness to engage in all-out war. And that just doesn't – that willingness, and it's exactly the point you made earlier about that question. We are so altruistic. We are so focused on – not asserting ourselves on, and if we do go to war, on protecting the enemy and not hurting civilians, and it's okay to sacrifice our young boys, or usually it's somebody else's young boys, but our neighbor's young boys, that we can't win. So my fight is on the principle that we need to be self-interested. We need to crush the enemy. How you do it if I can convince people on the principle, they're better military minds than me.
Mm-hmm.
To figure out how to do it exactly. You know, there's one hope. There's the general Patton and. What are we? Where are we now? We've got about a half an hour left of the show. I do want to talk about Mark Zuckerberg, so we're going to shift focus a little bit. So thanks for calling, and thanks for giving me the thumbs up in terms of the influence I've had. I really appreciate that, and you guys, it really means a lot because. You know, again, we intellectuals, we put stuff out there, and we often have no idea what kind of impact it all has, including this. So we are going to be right back after these commercials, and then we're going to talk about Mark Zuckerberg.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence at a man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem, these works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, we're back, and before we get to Mark Zuckerberg, I guess, we're going to take one more caller. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
This is Wes.
Hey, Wes, where are you calling from?
Hey, I'm from Arkansas.
Hey, Wes, how are you?
Fine, how are you doing, Yaron?
I'm doing well.
Just wanted to speak to this thing in terms of you making a difference and tell you for sure that you've made a huge difference on the work that I've done. And without your guidance over the years, I would have never taken on teaching a course on capitalism at the University of Arkansas. And we've done it for 4 years now and touched a couple of hundred kids or so, and the evaluations are just off the charts. It's changing lives, and, of course, again, without the knowledge you've given me and passed along, that would have never been successful. So
I appreciate that, Wes. Wes is a former CEO, a businessman, one of the few businessmen out there who actually stand up for capitalism, understand capitalism, and is be teaching a course at the University of Arkansas on capitalism that has used Atlas Shrugged as a main reading in the course. And I've had the pleasure of going out to the University of Arkansas teaching a couple of classes, and I know Don Watkins has been out there as well. And Wes, if more businessmen were like you in America, my job would be easy.
Well,
my job would be really easy.
Well, I appreciate that. I just, again, and we're still making changes here, and we're going to keep going on one way or another, and not give up the fight. And it's an easy decision because we're right about this, Yaron.
Absolutely.
We're right.
And I'm looking forward on Tuesday
on
Skyping
Tuesday.
Into your class.
Yeah, the class is looking forward to it. Yeah, the class is looking forward very to it too, Yaron. So,
good.
And your
good.
Last caller reminded me that you took on what to do about this thing. It reminded me of your comment to O'Reilly when you said, "Was it Fallujah? That should be reduced to dust." I think is what you told them. So.
Yeah, and I said that. That was in 2005.
Yeah, 2005. Go back a number of years ago. Yeah, anyway.
And 10 years later, we have to talk about the same thing.
Same thing.
Because there's nobody listed back then.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway.
Power of ideas. Thanks, Wes. I really appreciate the call, and I appreciate everything that you do to promote capitalism and to promote freedom and to make the future a better place for all of us. And that brings me to Mark Zuckerberg and his letter to his daughter. And unfortunately, I don't have enough time to really go into this, so we'll have to dedicate another show to this as well. But so I read, I don't know if you guys, everybody knows what happened here, is Mark Zuckerberg had a daughter. Congratulations to Mark. Mark Zuckerberg is the CEO, founder of Facebook, is worth something in excess of, I think, $50 billion. And he had a daughter this week, so congratulations to Mark. And he published a public letter to his daughter, which is, I think, you know, just that is a little ridiculous. And if you read the letter, you can see this isn't the kind of letter you give a child of yours. This is like a political manifesto that you send out. It's a little bizarre. Anyway, put that aside. So what Mark Zuckerberg is committed to doing is over his lifetime to contributing 99% of his Facebook stock worth about $45 billion to various charitable activities. Now, technically, they're not really charitable activities because he's actually forming an LLC, a limited liability corporation. And this entity will be allowed to invest actually in for-profit entities and so on. It will also, it's really focused on a few areas. It's not what I would call a traditional charity at all. And that's kind of one of the virtues of this. And for those curious about this, I think the Institute is going to get about, about $0 from their $45 billion. I think zero are going to come to the, trickle down to the Institute. So that maybe that's one of the reasons I'm unhappy with Mark, is because we're not getting any of it. So what do I want to talk about today? Because I think what I'm going to do is we're going to make this whole issue of Mark Zuckerberg's letter to his daughter and the whole question of charity and the virtue of charity, how important charity is, what to make of charity. I think we're gonna make that the topic of next week's show. I think we're just gonna, so because we don't have that much time today, I'm gonna just hold off on this, because what I'd really like to do, and I'd like to have the time to do, is to read to you from this letter. and try to do kind of a philosophical analysis of what is he, what is behind what Mark Zuckerberg is doing. Because it's not all bad, and it's this mixture. But the motivation, I find, the motivation is very bad. But this all relates to the whole issue of charity, the whole issue of giving, and then the whole issue of giving back, which many of you have heard me talk about giving back and why I'm against giving back, why the back is wrong. But this is a bigger issue, and it's a great issue for Christmas, right? It's a great issue for the season of giving, right? Supposedly. And what does it mean to give, and what circumstances one should give, and whether this whole thing is valid. So you know what? We're going to put Zuckerberg aside, and that's going to be the whole topic for next time. There's something else I want to talk about that is kind of a mixture, good news and bad news. And so this is kind of leads us into kind of the more positive side of the show, because it has a positive angle, but it's also really bad news at the same time. And it's also related to San Bernardino, if you can imagine that. And this is news that there's a new money has been raised to build the tallest skyscraper in the world. And it looks amazing. I mean, the building, I love architecture. I can't say I know anything about architecture, but I love beautiful buildings. I love, like Ayn Rand, I guess, I love skyscrapers. I love beautiful homes. I love modern architecture. I'm a huge fan of Frank Lloyd Wright's. And when I see skyscrapers, they inspire me. And skyscrapers are symbols of progress, of technology, of success, of man reaching to the stars, and everything's possible, and they're just these symbols of great achievement. And I love the skyline of New York, like Ayn Rand did, but I love, in some ways even more, the skyline of Hong Kong and the skyline of Shanghai, where I think there's real production and real productivity, and it's reflected in that skyline. It's reflected in the skyscrapers. Indeed, there are more skyscrapers today in Hong Kong than there are in New York City. So when I read that the new tallest building in the world is set, construction has already begun, but they've closed the funding. It's going to cost $1.2 billion. I was all excited. This is cool because this building is going to be a kilometer tall, 1 kilometer tall. And the design is quite stunning. If you look at it now, we'll get to the meaning of the design in a little while. But the design is quite stunning. It's an amazing building. I'm a civil engineer. I don't know if you guys know this, but my training in undergraduate school, at least, was in civil engineering. I'm a civil engineer, and the building, engineering wise, is a stunning achievement, and architecturally, it's gorgeous, and. This is great. The problem is, and by the way, did I say it's a kilometer tall? And it reminds me of something. It reminds me of the fact that Frank Lloyd Wright designed a mile-high building. This is in the 1950s. Frank Lloyd Wright designed a mile-high building. Of course, it was never built. With atomic elevators. That's how optimistic they were about the future of atomic energy, where they could think about elevators that were being, that the whole building would be, electricity would be provided by a nuclear generator as part of the design. And the Mahai building has been recently tested in wind tunnels with modern technology, and it would stand, which is an amazing, it's an amazing feat. So this reminded me of that, and I was all, wow, this is cool. This is so exciting. And then I look at where it's going to be built. And oh, my God. You know, we've got the tallest building today in Dubai. So an Arab emigrant that basically produces nothing, creates nothing, problem in the Middle East, part of the problem in the world, is run by sheikhs, who's I'm sure many charities provide gazillions of dollars to terrorists all across the world. That's the tallest building today. That's horrible enough. But the new one, which is going to be, I think, something like 500 feet even taller, is in Saudi Arabia, in Jeddah, on the Red Sea, on the shores of the Red Sea. So this beautiful kilometer-high masterpiece, I think, is going to be built in Saudi Arabia, a culture, a country, a regime that is barbaric. Saudi Arabia, guys. And, you know, it's why? Well, one, they have money. They have money because, you know, some people have money, right? The sheiks all have money because they stole all the oil discovered by Western companies. They nationalized it. Nationalizing by any other name is stealing. And because we consume so much oil, and because we won't drill in the United States, and we won't, you know, use the tar sands in Canada as much as we should, and we're not drilling in Alaska, and we're not drilling off the coast of California, and we're not fracking as much as we should. You know, these bastards have enough money to build the tallest building in the world. But why do they want to build the tallest building in the world? And this is where I think it gets interesting. Why is it that in the Middle East, these regimes that are religious, that fund terrorism, that are anti-Western, why do they want Western technology to build the tallest buildings in the world? What do they think they'll achieve by that? Well, my view is what they're looking for is confirmation of their superiority over the rest of us. Allah is on their side. Allah is on the side of Islam. A caliphate is possible. They can win. And symbols are important. Symbols are important. Tall buildings are symbols. They're symbols of wealth. They're symbols of success. They're symbols of prosperity. They're symbols of achievement. This is why I love skyscrapers. This is why Ayn Rand loved New York. When the barbarians start building skyscrapers, and we let them, in a sense that we're at war with these guys, we of course, an undeclared war, not a war we will admit, and yet we let them. And, you know, the difference here between these guys and like the Soviets and others who build monuments is these guys are using Western technology, we're supplying it freely. And they are outgunning us, in a sense, at our own thing, our thing. America's thing is skyscrapers. We invented them. We've been great at them. We've had the best skylines. And I don't mind when, in a sense, Asia so-called steals it, because Asia's doing it through productive effort. Asia's building skyscrapers because they're producing stuff, because they're making stuff. The Saudis are doing it because they got to steal all the oil. They got to nationalize. They're doing it as a symbol of their superiority, not as a symbol of the superiority of capitalism, not as an expression of freedom, but as an expression of the superiority of a religion of slavery. And that is both evil and upsetting and depressing. Ugh. It's really depressing. So, on the one hand, I admire the architects. On the other hand, I resent them from being willing to build this for the Saudis. I wouldn't. You know, the Atlases should shrug, at least in terms of some things. One of the reasons that the Soviets couldn't build this is they didn't have the money. We facilitate the money for the Saudis to build this, by our stupid environmental laws and by the fact that we won't recognize them as an enemy. And they didn't have the technology. And we facilitate the technology. It's our architects. Our Western architects. It's Western engineers. And at the end of the day, it's our money. So, great achievement. Inspiring. I get inspired by looking at buildings like this. I mean, Google it. And check it out. It really is quite an amazing quite an amazing building. It kind of goes way over the clouds, to the extent that they have clouds in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, not many of them. It has a beautiful antenna. It's structured in a way that the winds will not cause it to sway. It's an amazing engineering feat. It's also structured in a way so that not to be because it's next to the Red Sea, so the air has a lot of salt in it. There's a lot of salt water that seeps through the ground that could attack its foundation. So it's structured in a way as to not be corrosive or corrosed from the salt. So again, a massive technological, amazing achievement. All right. So I want to talk about something positive. We always end the show on a positive value. And instead of just, instead of just the usual, which is movies and maybe a composer, so I want to talk about painting and sculpture for a bit, and I'm not going to get very deep in this, just to encourage you all. So one of the things I try to do, and I'm not as good at it today as I was years ago, because my schedule's become so nutty and crazy and busy, but I want to encourage you all that as you travel around the world, if you travel around the world, I'd encourage you to travel, to go to museums, to go and get a sense of the great achievements of Western civilization, to go and appreciate the great sculpture of the Greeks and the Romans and of the Italian Renaissance and the Baroque and really all the way through the end of the 19th century. There were massive, amazing, beautiful, stunning achievements in sculpture and in painting. And I try to do that. Wherever I go to a new city, I try to find out what museums they have. And in every museum, even in little cities in America, you'll find some great works, and often great works that you didn't know existed, works that inspire, works that are interesting, works that are fun, works that are just uplifting. Now, not all great art is uplifting, but all great art serves to enhance a value, to support your life, to make your life better. So I was in St. Petersburg recently, and I went to the Hermitage. And wow, I mean, I wish I had more time to spend. It wasn't my favorite museum in the world. I think there are far better museums in the West. I think part of the problem in the Hermitage is it's not very well curated. It's a little haphazard, but it has some great art in it, and it's definitely worth just spending time. And you know, I've reached a point now where I can go through a museum fairly fast because I know what I like and what I don't like. But I recommend people to actually go slowly. Look at the paintings. Figure out what you like and figure out what you don't like. See what paintings have an emotional effect on you. Try to figure out why. Why some do and why some don't. Where does your eye go? What attracts you to a particular painting or particular sculpture? Why? What is it about that painting? What is it about the sculpture that is causing you to stop in front of it and not stop in front of the others? Do it slowly, but do it thoughtfully. Examine your own emotions. Examine your own thoughts. Examine the processes. What exactly is going on in your mind? I would do that. So I recently, as I said, was at the Hermitage. I would definitely recommend it. But I would recommend any city. My wife's in Madrid right now. She every time she's in Madrid, she visits the Prado. There might be a special exhibit on, or just to go see some of her favorite paintings that were at the Prado in Madrid, a wonderful museum. Or of course the Louvre, or the D'Orsay in Paris, or in London. The National Gallery is fantastic, and they often have amazing visiting exhibitions. They have some amazing Leonardo da Vinci there, and just some stunning paintings from all kinds of periods. And then there's a British artist who I really like. His name is Wright of Derby, Wright with a W, W-R-I-G-H-T, of Derby, who was a painter who painted the Industrial Revolution and the Scientific Revolution. And he painted a lot of paintings where you see science happening, which is very unusual Almost nobody does that. And they're very dramatic, and he uses light and shade very dramatically. Beautiful. And there's a painting in the National Gallery, one of his paintings there, and I would go there. I would go, in London, I would go to the British Tate, the old Tate, not the new Tate, God forbid, which has all the crazy so-called modern art. But the old Tate, which has a lot of the pre-Raphaelites and paintings by the great British academic painters of the 19th century, some amazing sculptures and amazing paintings at the British Tate. And almost nobody goes there. I try to go there, you know, at least every second time I'm in London. If I have time, I'll make a quick visit. And again, I can do the museum pretty quickly, but really inspiring and gives me some real positive energy when I'm there. And if you want to know one of the secrets to why I have so much positive energy, is it's because I'm an avid consumer of art. It helps that. Art provides that. Yeah. And somebody just mentioned on the chat, I would encourage everybody to go to the Leighton House in London. Frederick Leighton's house is a museum dedicated to Frederick Leighton. Frederick Leighton was one of the great artists of the 19th century. Very, very beautiful, beautiful, stunningly beautiful works. And the Leighton House has some of his some great pieces by him, including some sculpture. He both sculpted and painted, which was an amazing. I know that we have Liran, who is in Buenos Aires, who listens to the show and is on there. In Buenos Aires, I would go to the cemetery. The Buenos Aires Cemetery is a magnificent exhibition of sculpture. Just beautiful sculpture, dedicated to people who died. So there's an element of sadness in most of the sculptures. But wow, first of all, you get a sense of how rich Buenos Aires was in the 19th century, how successful a society, a culture it was. And by the way, I was going to talk about the new president of Argentina, who is a fan of the Fountainhead. But let's do that in a future show as well. I'll also get some more information about him. But the cemetery is truly amazing. I would definitely go in Buenos Aires to the cemetery. And the greatest cemetery, and I'll end with this, the greatest cemetery in the world, which has one of the greatest collections of sculpture anywhere in the world, is the cemetery in Milan, Italy. You could spend days in the cemetery in Milan, walking through the various the various sculptures, the various monuments. Some of my favorite people historically are buried there, like Verdi is buried there, and Toscanini, my favorite conductor of classical music, is buried there. But what you get a sense from the sculpture in Milan and in Buenos Aires is the incredible talent that so many sculptors had in the 19th century. And the value that people put on sculpture, put on great art in the 19th century, we've lost that. We have lost that. We have no sense of aesthetics, no sense of great art, other than maybe expressed in architecture. No sense of great sculptures surrounding our buildings or in our homes. No great paintings, no great murals being painted. So strongly recommend visit museums, even visit graveyards when they're great, like in Milan and Buenos Aires. So those are a few of my recommendations for great pieces of art, for great museums, for places to go and enjoy art. Go do it, experience it, get the fuel, and get to learn how to appreciate it. It takes practice. It doesn't come easily. Art is hard, particularly in a purely materialistic culture that we live in, where we're never taught how to appreciate art. You need to really think about it. You really need to experience it, and you need to do a lot of introspection. All right. You've been listening to the Iran Book Show. Next week, we'll be talking about Mark Zuckerberg. If you want to hear me for another hour, then you can listen later on today on AM 560 The Answer in Chicago. And next week I'll talk to you all at 11:30. We'll be talking about charity, Is it good? Is it bad? Mike Zuckerberg, as long as something else urgent doesn't come up, that'll be the topic. Talk to you all very, very soon. Bye.